It's Holy Week, the week before Easter, and many Americans are no doubt scrambling to find a church. Maybe they've moved or just want to try something a little different. Either way, finding a church just got easier online. From member station WBUR, Jessica Alpert reports.
As a military wife, Melissa Hager has to find a new church every time her husband is reassigned. While she's skilled at unpacking boxes, some things just aren't as easy. Online church reviews make settling in just a little less stressful.
When you move to a new town, you have a whole list of new pediatrician, new dentist, new playgroup, new friends, new hairstylist, and new churches on that list. And if I can get some insight on that online, it makes my life easier.
A few months ago, Melissa and her family moved to suburban Tucson and wanted to find a new church as soon as possible.
We're churchgoers. That gives us kind of a instant built-in family when we're in actuality strangers in these new towns.
Instead of relying on trial and error, Melissa visited a new website called churchraider.com. Co-founder Tyler Mahoney wanted to create a site that made church choosing less overwhelming. But he needed to set a few ground rules.
The internet is a mean, mean-spirited place, and the most grace-filled Christians can be hate-mongers on the internet. Here's the main criteria. Be polite.
Mahoney wanted Church Raider to be more dialogue and less diatribe.
We don't want people to criticize churches because that's not really that helpful. You know, don't tell me what I'm doing wrong. Tell me what I can do better.
Church Raider has hundreds of reviews, but Yelp.com has hundreds more. One house of worship with scores of ratings is Mars Hill Church in Seattle. Listen to these.
Mars Hill is an amazing church that I would highly recommend to anyone. It's all about Jesus all the time.
Mars Hill Church is a hate factory which preys on the naive, misguided, deluded, abused, lonely, and confused youth of Seattle.
People are angry at this church or call it a cult, do not understand the definition of a cult. And two, they are angry because Pastor Mark teaches exactly what the Bible says.
To sum it up, the entire service was on maintaining the power structure within the church. Men over women, deacons over congregation, pastors over deacons.
Sometimes it is helpful, and sometimes it's just ridiculous.
Mark Driscoll is the founding pastor of Mars Hill Church.
What I believe is what I believe, and there may be occasionally better ways to articulate it, but I'm certainly not going to change my beliefs about God based upon a comment at Yelp. I hope my convictions go a little deeper than that.
While some people who run churches aren't thrilled by online reviews, the trend also concerns those who teach ministry. Dr. Dwight Friesen is at Mars Hill Graduate School. No relationship to the church.
It kind of feels to me a little bit like ecclesial bandstand, if you will. It's got a good sermon, easy to worship to. I'll give it an 8.7.
Friesen says online reviews present bigger theological problems.
It reduces church to a commodity to be consumed. The church, at the end of the day, is not a commodity. It's a lot more like a family.
We're not reviewing our families on Yelp, at least not yet. But as Melissa Hager sees it, houses of worship are families of choice, and she needs something to help her choose.
As a military family, you don't have the luxury of inheriting a church. You have to find one. Church is about relationships, and it's not so easy to just walk in blindly to any place and not know what they're really going to be about.
The question is this: does a review tell you what the church is about, or what a reviewer is about? For NPR News, I'm Jessica Alpert.
Denouncing harsh fatwas and the hardline clerics who issue them has brought fame and possible fortune to one Saudi poet. Hissa Hilal wowed the judges and the audience to become only the second woman to make the finals in the Arab world's popular program Millions Poet. The show is similar to American Idol, but contestants recite poetry in the traditional Bedouin style. Hissa Hilal's verses described extreme clerics and fatwas as, quote, wearing death as a dress and covering it with a belt, as in suicide belt. She's now in Abu Dhabi preparing for next week's final vote on poetry she knows is risky to recite in public.
I have been writing since I was 12 years old, and I thought I have something to say to the people. If I don't do it this year, I think I'm not going to do it in my life.
What was it that you wanted to communicate? Because your poem, it's quite startling.
Yeah, the people know me when I started as a romantic Yeah. I used to write mostly about love and about life. But there are certain poems that I wrote strongly. I felt I should have the courage to say it in a strong way. If you say it in a soft way, nobody notices it.
In translations of the poem that got you to the finals, which of course will lose the full power of the language, but
but
for our listeners to get an idea of what you were saying, I understand you recited such lines as, "I have seen evil in the eyes of fatwas." It's a very strong message.
Yeah. You have to be courage and to say something, because I see violence and extremism become more and more strong. I want to give idea about those Arabs who are silent. They are silent, but they have the same idea I have.
And your family, they've supported you in this? Because I know you have a husband and children.
Yeah, my husband he's also a poet, and he said, "You don't afraid. I will support you as much as I can. Whatever happened to me, okay, I will not care. My poetry will be there."
It might be worth pointing out to listeners that there are limits in one sense. In this competition, when you appear on television,
yes,
you are fully covered. All one sees is your eyes and hears your voice.
Yes. This is a tradition. If I take it, all the tradition tribes, some of them, they will be shocked.
If you took off the veil.
Yeah, if I took it. I will lose the people, those who I want to talk to them, my people. I don't want to lose them because I'm going to say important things.
How are you feeling about the final round of the competition?
I feel good. I wish I can get the first position.
To come first, to win.
Yeah, I hope. I want to do it for the sake of all women, Arabs, and all around the world, to say there is nothing impossible. If you believe in your heart, you can do it.
Hissa Hilal is a finalist in the Arabic television competition, Millions Poet. Thank you very much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Rene.
And you can watch Hissa Hilal recite her poetry and also the audience's reaction at our website, npr.org.
And now across the country to California, where the last remaining auto plant on the West Coast is shutting down today. It was a unique operation run jointly by Toyota and General Motors until GM went broke and pulled out. Now Toyota's pulling the plug on New United Motor Manufacturing, better known by its nickname, NUMMI. NPR's Richard Gonzalez says nearly 5,000 workers in the Fremont, California plant are about to be jobless.
The end of NUMMI really started late last week. That's when the company released about 1,000 workers who built Tacoma trucks. Some gathered in a local restaurant just an hour or so after they had filed out of the plant for the last time. They included 17-year veteran Kurt Sanders.
My daughter texted me earlier this morning. I lost it. That's what kind of set it off. You know, I was good till then. And as soon as my daughter texted me, you know, everything's going to be fine, we'll be okay, and this and that, that's when the river started.
There were hugs, tears, and more than a few beers as workers traded phone numbers and email addresses. Lisa Wilmer spent almost 18 years on the assembly line.
Well, there's some people that you'll stay in touch with. There's some that you don't care to stay in touch with. The hardest part is the ones that you really like and you know that you're never going to see again. That's the part that's really hard to deal with.
Many of the workers still wonder why Toyota is closing NUMMI. It opened in 1984 as an experiment to see whether unionized American workers could adapt to Japanese management practices. They did. But more than two decades of building high-quality cars wasn't enough to convince Toyota to keep the plant open after GM pulled out. Toyota officials say NUMMI simply wasn't economically viable. But many workers suspect that it may have something to do with their union. This was Toyota's only unionized workforce. And Ezra worked for NUMMI for more than two decades.
Toyota has never shut a plant down in 73 years. And we were the only plant to ever get a zero defect audit. ever in the Toyota history. Only another Lexus plant's ever done it, and they're going to shut us down? Why? So, yeah, it's because of the union.
Ezra stops short of saying more. Workers have agreed not to denigrate the company in exchange for a severance package averaging about $50,000 depending on years of service. 4,700 workers will lose their jobs, and UC Berkeley labor expert Harley Shaken says the NUMMI closure will have a spillover effect on scores of other businesses.
The 20,000 workers who will be impacted by the NUMMI closure work in direct suppliers, some of which who will be totally closed. They also are related workers, the people in the restaurants down the street, the school teachers and nurses in hospitals and schools where NUMMI workers live. The impact of this is going to be felt deeply.
Some local leaders hope to recruit another car maker to Fremont, but Mayor Bob Wasserman says he foresees housing and retail development, perhaps even a ballpark, on the 380-acre site.
If Toyota's the biggest and best automaker in the world, if they can't make a profit there, who in the world can? So its future as being as it was in the past is not likely.
NUMMI worker Johnny Rowe has a piece of the past he'll hang on to. Back at the restaurant saying his goodbyes, Rowe stands next to a late model Tacoma truck.
Oh man, the truck I drive, I actually saw it get built. So there's some pride in what we drive. There really is. When I leave the plant, I'm still sitting in the plant. You know, driving every day, I'm kind of bringing a piece of NUMMI with me.
The last NUMMI-made Toyota Tacoma truck rolled out last Friday. Today, the last Toyota Corolla will leave the plant, and the workers who made it will file out to a final round of farewells. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, Fremont, California.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Many colleges and universities are in financial trouble, and that means tuition hikes. For students struggling to cover those hikes, the new health care law should bring sweeping changes to federal student financial aid. But as Tara Seiler reports, many students, especially community college students, are not taking full advantage of the help that's available right now.
The Pell Grant program provides grants to low-income undergraduate students if only more would apply.
These students are leaving money on the table, and a Pell Grant is money that does not need to be repaid.
Mark Kantrowitz is publisher of FinAid, an online guide that helps students find funding for college. He estimates that about 2 million eligible students nationwide are forgoing this federal assistance, with the worst rates among community college students. Here in California, those students leave about $500 million in federal Pell Grants untapped. That's according to Debbie Cochran with Berkeley's Institute for College Access and Success.
Accessing up to $5,000 in grant aid, we think, would enable students to cut back their work hours, you know, maybe take one or two more classes and take a full-time load rather than a part-time load, and be able to get through their degree program faster.
Pell Grants, available to those who make less than $50,000 a year, can pay for anything a student needs, books, transportation, housing, or tuition. But students who might want the grants face a major hurdle, the paperwork.
Do you know anything about this process?
A little bit.
Do you want to know something about this process? I'd be very happy to tell you.
Financial aid officer Ron Salazar is cajoling a student at Diablo Valley Community College east of San Francisco to fill out the free application for federal student aid known as FAFSA. The online form is the necessary stepping stone to all federal financial aid. Student Chad Burquest walks outside with worksheets in hand. Last year, he gave up on the federal form.
It was so daunting, so challenging to fill out the FAFSA, especially in my first year of college. And then now, the second year into it, you know, I'm a little bit more aware of the system.
The 29-year-old Burquest is a recession student, a surging demographic at community colleges. He lost his job as a crane operator and is looking to be retrained.
Because I realized that education would be the only way to further my employment for the rest of my life.
But educating California's community college students about financial aid is a challenge. Brenda Jerez is the director for financial aid at Diablo Valley College.
We have the immigrant population that comes from a country in which college, financial aid, all those things don't exist. And then we have our domestic students that parents never have gone to college. They don't even know how college operates.
Still, Jerez says her understaffed office works hard to get the word out. 18-year-old Jasmine Vega filled out her application while a senior in high school. Now a full-time college student and a young mother, Vega is receiving about $5,000 in federal and state assistance this school year.
Financial aid is really helpful when you don't really have anything.
Could you still be a student without it, do you think?
I don't think so. No.
There will be even more federal financial aid available next fall. The trick will be to make sure community college students realize it's out there, that it can help, and that the paperwork hassle is worth it. For NPR News, I'm Tara Seiler in San Francisco.
People and politicians are absorbing President Obama's surprise announcement to expand offshore oil and gas drilling. The president has ended a drilling moratorium that stretched from the Gulf Coast of Florida to the Atlantic beaches of Delaware. He's also proposing more drilling in the waters north of Alaska. Scott Finn of member station WUSF takes to Florida's beaches to gauge the risks and the benefits of drilling.
Kathy Douglas power walks through the soft white sand of St. Pete Beach, past seagulls and rows of pale sunbathers soaking up the morning rays. She loves this beach so much, she moved here, and now spends her free time trying to stop offshore drilling.
So why jeopardize all of this beauty and a tourism industry? So why take the risk?
The risk isn't just for St. Pete Beach. A spill far offshore could foul beaches hundreds of miles away. But visitors Jane and Louis Pinto from Philadelphia don't think it's much of a danger.
I think it's proven to be pretty safe. And if it's that far off, Las Lanas doesn't interfere with the tourists and the beach and everything. I think you have to do something besides just the green movement, going to keep the economy going.
Basically to, you know, get off our dependency on foreign oil.
Environmental groups claim there's just a six-month supply of oil in these waters. But University of South Florida geologist Al Hine says there may be more. The government's data is old and incomplete, and the industry is spending millions to explore deep waters far from shore.
The oil industry is right now, to best of my knowledge, I've seen the maps, out there shooting seismic. It's all proprietary data. It's extremely expensive. If they didn't think there was anything there, they wouldn't be spending the money to collect the data.
The oil and gas industry has responded to the president's move with muted praise and demands for much more. Here's David Micah, executive director of the Florida Petroleum Council.
Of course, we in the industry are hopeful that as we move forward, that consideration can be given to some other resource-rich areas. Nonetheless, that is positive.
Used to be, Democrats and Republicans in East Coast states came together to oppose offshore oil and gas production. But now is the age of drill, baby, drill. Polls now show a majority of Americans and a majority of Florida residents supporting offshore drilling. President Obama says increased drilling is a bridge until alternative energy is developed. Back on St. Pete Beach, Kathy Douglas calls it something else.
I definitely think it is a crutch. And it's a crutch because if we have fossil fuels that are so easily available, then we cease to try to develop the technology that makes alternative energy affordable to the average person.
The battle is not over yet. Now comes years of study and lawsuits before drilling can begin off Alaska and from the Florida Gulf to the coast of Delaware. For NPR News, I'm Scott Finn in Tampa.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. President Obama has scored several big political wins recently. The passage of a health care law, and with it big changes to student loan regulations, plus an important nuclear deal with Russia. But the president is not getting everything he wants. NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore explains.
Since the Cold War, big powers sometimes have difficulty getting their wishes respected. The president demands that Israel cease building new housing units in East Jerusalem. Israel ignores him, and life goes on. Russian control of the North Caucasus is challenged by suicide bombs in the Moscow subway, and life goes on. President Obama flies overnight to Kabul to tell President Karzai to get serious about cracking down on rampant corruption in his government. Karzai plays host to Iranian President Ahmadinejad, America's principal adversary in the Middle East, for a speech denouncing the United States, and life goes on. The buildup of American forces continues even though Karzai has ignored American demands that he rein in his drug cartel-friendly brother, even though Karzai has let it be known that his interests and America's may no longer coincide. That Karzai is held in low regard by the American military is well known. He's widely considered to have stolen his election last August. His promises to deal with corruption in his government are taken as feeble. It may be no coincidence that about the time President Obama was planning his visit to Kabul, Newsweek appeared with a cover story headlined, "How We've Wasted $8 Billion on a Corrupt and Abusive Police Force That May Cost Us the War." I'm reminded of the Vietnam War when President Kennedy supported the ousting of an ineffectual South Vietnamese leadership headed by President Ngo Dinh Diem. The Obama administration has no uncorrupted Afghan leader to install, even if it could. And so, the buildup of American forces in Afghanistan to 100,000 continues, and the publicized anger of the American forces continues. This is Daniel Shore.